we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene, and tonight special guest host Simon is with me. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
And tonight we're going to be starting a new TV series here on Fusion Patrol. We're going to be talking about the classic 1960s sort of spy, sort of science fiction, sort of mind warp series, The Prisoner, starring Patrick McGoohan. And this, well, there's just really no way to describe this series except we're just going to have to go through it. So let's start with a synopsis of the very first episode, Arrival.
I'm looking forward to hearing this.
Well, if you'd watched the episode, this would... All right. An agitated man storms into an office and angrily tenders his resignation. He leaves, still furious. On his way home, he's followed by a hearse, and upon arrival home, they gas him, and he awakes in his own apartment, now seemingly transplanted to a Mediterranean village. He wanders the village looking for answers, but he finds none. The quaint village has some curiously high-tech equipment, but there is no information on where he is, how to get out, or how to call out. Everything is also curiously well-labeled. The villagers are particularly unhelpful. He returns to his apartment, and he receives a call from someone who self-identifies as Number Two, inviting him round for breakfast. They meet in Number Two's headquarters for working breakfast. They demonstrate that they have exactly what he was going to order before he orders it. They question him about his resignation. Why did he resign? What were his motives? They demonstrate that they have surveilled him for his entire lifetime, and he refuses to cooperate, and they refuse to give him any information about who they are. He's given a tour of the village, which includes a demo of the villagers' obedience, and Rover, the automated watchdog. He's given a bizarre test at the labor exchange, and they try to hypnotize him. But he storms out and returns to his home, which transforms from his familiar apartment into a high-tech home, complete with unstoppable, soothing music. Pacing like a caged animal, he destroys the radio. He is assigned a maid. He tries to question her, but she breaks down crying and explains that they wanted her to gain his confidence. Sobbing, she explains that if he'd just give her some information, they might let her go. She fails to elicit information, and all the while, they are monitoring him from their control room. He tries to escape through the woods, but Rover blocks him at every turn. He heads for the beach, where a fight breaks out with him and some guards. He overcomes them and steals their vehicle, but Rover overcomes him, and he's taken to hospital. He awakens and discovers Cobb, someone he knows, probably a colleague. Cobb says he's been there for weeks. They take him for some tests, and he sees a series of horrific scenes straight out of a madhouse. As he returns to his ward, Cobb jumps to his death and kills himself. The next morning, they issue him new clothes, paperwork, and other accoutrements of society. I mistyped that sentence. All of which identify him as Number Six. He makes an exaggerated effort to disregard and dispose of them. He returns to Number Two's chambers only to discover that he has been replaced by a new Number Two. Later, outside his window, he sees a cheerful funeral parade for Cobb, but one woman lags behind, crying in grief. He approaches her and tries to get her cooperation. She and Cobb had an escape plan, but had failed to implement it in time. We learn that she's assigned to Cobb by Number Two, and now that he's dead, she's been assigned to Number Six. But is she playing both sides? She claims to be working to help Cobb, despite her orders. She gives him a pass to escape in the helicopter, which he does. But as he flies away, they take remote control and bring him back. She watches, devastated, as she realizes they were using her disloyalty to them against Number Six. In the control room, Cobb is still alive and colluding with Number Two. He leaves, dressed in traditional London city clothes, referring to his new masters. Number Six is herded back by Rover. The cage is still firmly shut.
Bravo, well done.
Yeah, we did a couple of minor stumbles along the way, but this is it's really more of a setup, I think, and with a sort of escape story. I think I've mentioned it in the past that some shows suffer from pilotitis, wherein they have a lot of time to explain the setup, and then they feel they have to put one little adventure in towards the end to justify it as a single episode story. But that notwithstanding, this one has a lot of ground to cover, perhaps more so than most shows. So I understand that you have watched The Prisoner before, but not all of it, and then what you have seen was a long time ago?
It's been over 20 years since I've seen it at all. I don't know if I've watched this episode. I don't remember which episodes I've watched. So yeah, I'm kind of coming to it with fairly fresh eyes.
So how did the first episode grab you?
I don't know. I mean, I think you did well kind of summarizing the episode, because it is so fantastically complicated, but also full of
menace.
There's menace, but there are red herrings, non sequiturs, and it's a bit like an onion in the sense of you think someone is you take someone at face value, but it turns out there's a double cross or a double cross to a double cross, and you never quite feel you've got to the heart of what's going on. You've just peeled another layer off of it. So it's a really hard series, I think, to describe if you haven't actually seen it.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think a lot of this episode, so there is this sense of prevailing surveillance. I mean, that's quite obvious, but it's more than that. It's like when they go to breakfast and he's asking him, you know, do you want tea or coffee? And he'll say, tea. And that's all they've got. And do you want eggs with your bacon? Yes, one or two. And it turns out all they've got is two eggs and bacon. And just right down the line, we know you. We know everything there is to know about you, except this one little thing we want to know, which is why you resigned.
That to me, that scene is the standout scene in the episode. It's absolutely fantastic, and it is everything that is great about this show. And I mean, I think there's something, it's more than just the surveillance aspect to it. There is something about this show, and it's a kind of thing about 1960s genre of television that is ever so much about performance. And it's not just that it's putting on an entertainment for the viewers, it's also there's a real sense within the show that people are being watched, and they know they're being watched, and so they react to that. So you get a sense with number six through this that all the time he is, there are little clues everywhere that he's being watched. So mm-hmm. he is perhaps playing up to that. You're never quite sure when he's playing up to that and when the emotion he's displaying is genuine, and when it's something he's doing for the cameras, for the watchers.
It's like when he was pacing in his room.
Exactly.
I got the feeling there that was genuine fury, that he was getting fed up. and honestly, Patrick McGoohan is an incredible actor, or I have seen him do some incredible acting roles. He often plays this thing so tight and so constrained. I mean, you just feel like this man is wound up tight as a spring.
And it's that classic espionage thing, I guess, of you have someone whose job is to play a role, and so there is a kind of acting element to it, but it's not acting in the traditional sense of you have people on stage and you have an audience who know the people on stage are pretending. it's a much more complex, multi-layered relationship, because you have the agent whose aim is to fool the people around them, but there's always the question of, well, do they suspect? Does he know that he's not who he says he is? And in this case, they're looking at him all of the time, trying to work out what he's thinking about them. How much does he realize about the environment he's in?
And we as the audience really aren't given anything either.
We're deliberately blindsided repeatedly.
Yeah, and so we don't know. Is this the British government? I mean, the people all seem to be British, but of course it's a British show. There's a lot of international people there. They mentioned that they have Poles and Czechs, and of course those would have been behind the Iron Curtain at this time. There's this Cobb at the end, his former colleague, leaving. And he looks dressed as if he's in John Steed clothes, the umbrella, the bowler, the whole nine yards. You can't imagine that he's going anywhere but straight back to London, really. And yet he talks about, well, I mustn't keep my new masters waiting. So
yeah.
Is he working for British intelligence or not? It just, you don't get it, which is part of the brilliance of this show.
Because you quickly get into this idea that you're being led to think one thing, but then it turns out to be another, and you're being led to something else, but then there's a twist, and it's not what you expected. And so initially, and it has this fabulous thing of what in a modern TV series would probably be the pre-credit sequence of the first episode, the whole setup, mm-hmm. where he goes into the boss's office and tenders his resignation and all the rest of it. Only in this, it is actually the title sequence, the credits themselves.
Yeah.
And the theme, which is great, acts as a kind of incidental playing under that sequence that establishes the whole story. And so you get that premise really sort of compacted into that, which sets it up as if, and you know, what you're kind of being led into in this episode, and I honestly don't remember if we learn something different later, but the premise suggests that, yes, it is his employers, his ex-employers, British intelligence, trying to find out what lies behind his decision to resign. But pretty quickly, I'm thinking, well, how do we know that that's who these people are? Because this is a really, really complex and expensive setup. I mean, we can see, just in terms of the technology involved, that this is involved a great deal of resource. But also, if we're to believe the woman who's sent to look after his house, it's been there a long time. Because she talks about, you know, being a second generation in the village and being totally isolated. So what kind of return would you expect to get setting that up? I mean, it would have to be something big.
Is it also, I mean, no spoilers for future episodes, but I think it's safe to talk a little bit about what some of the things Patrick McGoohan has talked about. And this idea came about, he came up with the idea. And Patrick McGoohan is part of the creative team that drove this program after his work with Danger Man and Secret Agent, where he played a very stand-up and traditional secret agent character. He read about basically an internment camp that the good guys had, where they put their old spies, I think in World War II, to keep them from giving up their secrets. So part of this village, like what they show with the old admiral, you know, this is your retirement. This is where you go when you stop being useful. And so you could look at it as being, I can't exactly say benevolent, because obviously it's forced incarceration. But at the same time, they could just kill him. You quit the Secret Service, and we can't afford the bad guys to get you. It's a very complicated arrangement.
Could be the that's one reading of it, where you have the kind of benign, the resources being invested here in order to create the best possible, I don't know how you put a good spin on being a prisoner, but you know, it's a lovely environment, apart from the fact that your freedom is taken from you. It's a nice place to be. You're given everything you could want. So you've got that on the one hand. On the other hand, there's every possibility, certainly as far as I can see from watching this first episode, that this could be a pretext that if you were a foreign power wanting to extract secrets, that as a pretext, you could set that up.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there's nothing in this that says, you know, the guys that followed him in a hearse, the people behind this, the setup behind this, are actually British intelligence. And particularly the setup with Paul Eddington's character leaving at the end, dressed, as you say, in the city suit, ready, as it were, to go back to work, made me think, you know, it looks like he's going back to MI6 or whoever as their agent, but he doesn't work for them anymore. He works for his new bosses. So are his new bosses, you know, are they the Russians? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. He could be going back to be a double after they converted him. Yeah.
We're not given a great deal to go on in terms of that.
So one of the reasons that I like The Prisoner, and I've been a fan of The Prisoner for many years, and it's that there are a few programs, and I'll call this a science fiction program, but, you know, it's... You and I had this discussion once before about whether or not The Avengers is a science fiction program. There are trappings of science fiction here, but it is not exactly a science fiction premise and setup. And we could say, you know, the phones that don't have cords and the wireless radios, unpowered wireless radio boxes and things...
Touch screens.
Yeah, or are all science fiction things in the 1960s and totally... I mean, look at the way he picked up the phone. The first time he picks up that phone and he realizes it's got no cord. And he's like, okay. And uses the phone. Looking at that now from 2013, if he didn't react, no one would notice. A lot of what was science fiction when this went in place is commonplace now. And I wonder if new audiences who were to watch this show would understand just how different this environment he's in is. And it brings up a lot of questions that, honestly, in 1960, whatever it was. 67? Yeah. Privacy, your sense of freedom. In a civilized world, I mean, do you really have freedom just because you can go about in your town or in your country? You know, how is that any different? They've just constrained it to a smaller, space in the village, but is it really any different? And these questions have just become more and more relevant over the years than they were back then. So, in a way, I think the show has remarkable foresight. For the things that could go wrong in this world.
Yeah, I mean, I think those concerns carry forward, and the way in which it's constructed, the village itself is, you know, it could be, we talk about this environment for X agents, which is safe and secure, and obviously number six is promised by number two that if he cooperates, there are benefits he's going to get a better position, and there's a democratic council running the place. But also there are things like the labour exchange, where I'm thinking that isn't something that in a small community like that surely you would actually need, particularly one where all of the personnel files are known and available and all those things could be assigned. It's more like what you're getting there are the familiar kind of... It's reflecting what people expect society to be like.
So do you think the labor exchange is a euphemism there. I mean, they appear to be trying to brainwash him with that, or hypnotize him in that room. Instead of being a quote-unquote labor exchange, do you think that this is basically a slavery exchange? They are processing people into doing work for the village. And so it's kind of it's almost a joke, the name. It's not quite what it's labeled. Just because it says labor exchange, it's more, see what I'm getting at? Kind of that it's a euphemism for what they're really doing, which is indenturing people into working in the village.
I think there's an element of that, but I think there's also an element of it's reflecting something back, which is when you look at that and you look at it and you think there isn't really a need for it in the way this village is set up. You look at it and you think, actually, what role is the labour exchange or the modern job centre as it is now actually playing in our society? I mean, all of the concerns that you mentioned, the concerns that are being reflected back by this, that's what you're getting when you question these things in this macro, in this sort of micro version of society. Then you have to go back and you have to say, but hang on a minute, if that's ridiculous in the context of the village, how much more sense does that actually make sense in terms of our own lives?
I think there is no doubt that the village is meant to be allegorical.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty obvious. So why is everything labeled? What's your thought on that? I mean, it's not ISO 9000 or whatever the one is that you have to go label everything, but is that spoon-feeding us what we think, what we see, what we know, or is there something else? Or is it just another quirk of the village?
We didn't have any particular thoughts about that. I mean, I kind of assumed that in the village, you need the labels to know what's going on because it doesn't look like a regular town or city. I mean, it's a very striking place. It's a very striking location.
Because I wondered if there's, and obviously some of them are just, there's no apparent ambiguity there, that the boat is the boat and the village green is the village green. I mean, everything is labeled in there, but I'm wondering if there is something consistent with the fact that we will never learn the prisoner's name. And I think that's not spoiler enough. That's not a spoiler for the series, but he is the prisoner. He is number six.
You could say the same about the doctor.
Yeah, you will never learn the name of the prisoner. He is number six. They don't. In fact, the only name I think in the entire series is Cobb that they ever mention. Everyone else is a number, at all times. I won't swear to that, but that's my recollection. Is that that's the only time. And you know what's in a name? It really doesn't matter. In fact, we could extend this discussion to the doctor. It really doesn't matter what his name is in the village. He only has an identity in as much as it relates to the context of the people around him. So it doesn't matter if his name's John Drake or Jim Smith or the doctor. It's just a label. Just like everything else is labeled in the village. Number six is labeled. And number two is labeled, and it's not even a person. It's a job. Whoever comes and goes in that position, and we have two number twos in this episode, is just number two, and everyone just accepts him as number two, and off you go. Again, I think this is McGowan and company playing with a sense of identity. They are trying to make him into something that he is not. They are trying to conform him to the identity that the village wants him to be. And the battle we see here is him refusing to be what they want him to be. It's not just a question of escaping and getting out, or even finding out who these people are and destroying them or shutting them down. It's a question of him maintaining his own self-identity, his own self-integrity. And their job is to break down that integrity so that they can mold him into something that they want him to be. So you could say it's a brainwashing technique, but you could also apply that as being how we all change through the people and the circumstances around us in society or family, yeah, or whatever.
For him, it's clearly very strongly, I mean, you get it in this episode, I guess, because it's the first episode, that is a continuation. He clearly conveys that what he's picking up there is a continuing battle. This is not something different from why he resigned. It's part of the same thing. The fact that he wants to express himself as a person and that he doesn't want to divulge his reasons or personal, you know, his personal information in that regard. He wants his privacy and he doesn't want to accept their labels and their identity.
So I kind of wonder if he is, you know, if that resignation letter, if we could have seen what it said, if it gave his reasons for resigning. So do his former employers have a sense of why he was resigning and they don't believe it? Or did he not provide them with a reason? Or, you know, is the village run by somebody else and they don't know because they can't see what the letter is? Unanswered questions. But again, part of the reason the show endures.
The questions obviously depend on who the mysterious people running the place are. But from the audience point of view, it almost feels like we kind of don't actually need to see the resignation letter because we get such a strong sense of who he is from those exchanges that he has, saying he is not a number, he is a person, that kind of thing that becomes a mantra. But it feels very much like the reason that he has resigned is connected with that. He no longer accepts the role that has been placed on him, and they do not appear to have the capability to understand that someone might not want to fit or conform in that way. And there's the conflict, if you like. There's the dichotomy in it.
Are you familiar at all with Danger Man or Secret Agent, his earlier, more traditional role?
I've maybe seen an episode or two, but no, I couldn't really tell you anything about it.
So obviously they're not the same company, and so they aren't the same guy. Right, I mean, they'll tell you that. No, they can't possibly be because of copyright issues. But Patrick McGoohan played a very, very upright agent. And part of this is Patrick McGoohan, is my understanding, right? I have to pass this on by stuff that I've heard and read over the years, but without ever sitting down with Patrick McGoohan and talking to him about it. But he intentionally played the part in what he considered to be an extremely moral way. And that includes, for example, he never kisses a woman in the shows. Because, you know, he's not James Bond. He's not playing these people that way. He is he's straight up ramrod, honest guy. And of course, that's kind of the character he's playing here in the village, and that's why a lot of people say, you know, this is John Drake carried forward after he resigns from the Secret Service. It's a logical progression. But I think a lot of it, because of McGoohan developed it, I think in his mind, he probably said, what happens if this kind of character I played went on to the next level? And I could see how, you know, given his position on Secret Agent and Danger Man, that he would envision this is the kind of man who would quit a job on principle. So it's not, oh, somebody died and I just can't take this anymore, or, you know, whatever happens to be. It's my bosses came to me and said, I want you to fake that there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. can you do that for me? And he, you know, the hell with that. I will not do that, and resign. That's the impression I get, and that carries forward from what I get from John Drake from having seen those shows. So I guess I'm asking that. I guess you don't need that to get that in these opening credits, because I can't divorce the fact that I've seen all those in advance of this. So
no, to me that feels like it's almost because his role and his attitude is it kind of transcends the particulars of what he might have been asked to do. It's the fact that he was part of an organization. He played a role within that organization. And so that organization had certain expectations of him, you know, to put the institution above his own personal needs, his own personal morality. And so what you get from I mean, like I say, that very efficient, that very tight title sequence is that for whatever reason, he has had enough of that, and he's inverting it and saying, no, I'm putting myself above whatever you want me to do. And so that's what carries forward, the fact that he is fighting for self and his own personal identity and not being pigeonholed and not being fitted into a particular role.
A square hole in a round peg. I think that scene in the labor exchange where he goes in and they say, we want you to do this test, and they give him a round peg, and the only thing he can stick it in is a square hole. And when he sticks it in there, the hole closes in as a circle to make it fit perfectly. It's like if there isn't a more metaphor being bashed over your head than, you know, making this the round peg in the square hole fit. I don't know what is. I mean, that wasn't remotely subtle. In fact, it's almost like they're telegraphing it to him, not the audience. It's like, you be aware, you will fit in. It's a threat. It's the silliest thing, but in a way, it's a threat. And I think when they walked him up and down the hospital and showed him the people who were in the straitjackets, or the guy who'd obviously just had his brain operated on, or the other guy who was gibbering at the little water fountain or whatever it was, like that was hey, these are the consequences of not playing ball.
And absolutely, and almost everything that he, from the moment that number two stops everyone, and you kind of realize, or he gets a demonstration of how orchestrated everything is, you realize that nothing that he sees can be accidental. It's all been designed to have an impression on him.
And yet, by that same token, that exact same scene also tells you that not everyone is. Or maybe it doesn't tell you that, but not everyone is conformed, because you do have that one guy in the fountain who doesn't obey, and Rover takes him out. But on the other hand, maybe he was supposed to do that to give number six hope. I don't know.
But you really try to outguess
these guys.
You know, does he get? It's not just hope. It's a question of he sees straight away what happens to someone who doesn't. Since you mentioned this in the synopsis, you're calling the nice big balloon thing Rover.
Yes.
Did I miss something?
It's not mentioned in the episode. I don't think it's ever called that in the series, but it's called Rover. That is the name that it was. Okay. It was in the scripts. It's called Rover, but they never call it that.
I wondered if I'd missed something. Also, while I'm on things I might have missed. You say that it's a Mediterranean location he's been taken to.
Feels like that to me. But I know where it is.
That wasn't something... Obviously, it's in beautiful Wales.
It's in beautiful Wales. I was going to ask you later if you had if you'd been there.
Port Merion. No, I haven't, actually, but I'd love to.
Now you'll have to go.
Yeah.
My understanding, and I put Mediterranean there because what my reading about that town was that it was meant to have a Mediterranean feel. The architecture and the home styles. I can't say I haven't been to the Mediterranean, but I went with that on a...
Certainly, the architecture is very distinctive and interesting.
It's definitely not British looking.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the Green Dome a little bit, but the rest of it kind of... has a something feel. And I think, you know, obviously that's what they're going for. I think they got an incredible location for this. I mean, if they'd had to build that, I don't know whether or not they had the village mapped out before they wrote the show, but if they had had to build sets to accomplish what they were able to do in this little town, they'd have never pulled it off. It's a sumptuous location. I mean, it's pretty, it's distinct. It doesn't look like anything else that the British shows had in the 60s. Typically, when they went overseas, it was a back lot at Pinewood, and that looks like a back lot at Pinewood usually.
No, you can see why they got a helicopter into this one and got some good aerial shots, so you could definitely see it was
a bit much of that. Yeah, I felt they stretched that out a little too long. You know, first they had the tour, and they showed him around, and then when he left, I mean, the flight out, and then when they turn him around and they bring him back was way too long for television time, but I understand why they did it for him. They wanted to, you know, give him a sense of freedom. I'm getting away. You know, make that last just as long as they can, and then drag him back slowly, inexorably, just to help break his will.
But I think there was a problem with the pacing, and as you say, it's the pilotitis thing. This isn't a very well structured episode, or didn't feel like it to me in a sense, because you do get 40 minutes of one story and then you get an almost complete break, in the sense of you get the first story is with one number two and the whole establishing the location and the premise, and then the second story is with the woman who knew Kolb and the other, the George Baker. Mm-hmm. Number two, and that's got to have its kind of own plot, but it's only got 20 minutes to do it in, so it is basically, you know, nip into the helicopter, fly about a bit, get dragged back again.
I think they do effectively convey that the woman was assigned to Cobb. At least I think I'm getting this out of the episode. You can break the layers down, but the woman was assigned to Cobb, unknowing that Cobb was already one of their agents. So Cobb is playing her to get her to fall in love with him, because that's pretty obvious that was her motivation. And she did things, like with the helicopter pilot, to steal the ElectroPass. Whether or not the helicopter pilot was in on it or not is another story, so that they could lead her to a place of trying to get Cobb out because she loves him, even though she's supposed to be monitoring, but he's really monitoring her. And then his staged death to transfer that to number six. And just, I think she convinces number six. I'm not sure whether or not she convinces him she's genuine or not, but he has to go for it one way or the other. And that's a little bit of the ambiguity of his character. And then to have that, you know, slam down on him and slam down on her, that she's just been played from end to end. It's not an uncomplex story in that way, or setup, I should say, because that's not exactly a story. That's just setup.
Yeah. Yes, it is setup, because in a sense, the payoff would be finding out why, for example, Cobb had played her in that way. What exactly was the game? Because that's not at all clear.
No,
it's a lot. It's a lot of effort. But
yeah,
why is that? Why is that the best way of getting what they want? And what do they want anyway?
Yeah, did they set that up for when number six would arrive? In which case, they knew he was going to resign because he hasn't been there long enough for them to have staged that. And you know, why not? I mean, they know they have those dossiers and all the information on him and what's going on. Maybe they knew his resignation was coming. I think. Actually, don't we see the hearse before he drives into the car garage? I think we do. I think as he pulls into the garage, we see the front of the hearse come out, which means they knew what was going on. They were planning his abduction before he quit. I'll have to check that, but I think we see it.
I don't remember, so yeah.
Well, the opening credits that we see in this pilot are, I don't want to say longer, but they're different from the rest of them a little bit, subtly here and there. There's scenes cut out, scenes added, and I think in the very first one, we see the hearse before the abduction or before the resignation, and then in the other ones, I don't think we do.
But you know, here's the thing about the prisoner, that because the prisoner, I mean, one thing about it is we had this discussion about science fiction and whether or not it actually counts as science fiction, and also we have this ongoing disagreement over whether it matters about whether it counts as science fiction. But to me, there's as strong a feel about this show as being a kind of the feel of that genre of espionage shows as much as there is for the science fiction stuff. And you're right, we kind of had this discussion about whether the Avengers goes one way or the other, and I kind of get that very espionage vibe about it as well. But for these shows, with a kind of strong male lead like John Steed or Number Six, or even the Doctor, particularly the Pertwee era Doctor Who, there's this very strong kind of visual identity to them, that Patrick McNee's costume is very important, with the bowler and the three-piece suit and everything. Likewise, what John Pertwee wears. And in The Prisoner, we have almost like a scene where when the Doctor regenerates, during that regeneration episode, like the episodes we've been talking about in our series, that there's always the moment where the Doctor puts on his new costume. And we get that in the hospital again, where he's given that kind of trademark jacket that becomes his costume through the mm-hmm. show. And somehow that's very important to these shows, that you have this kind of strong visual identity.
But he, unlike everyone else has their old-style bicycle badge with their number and, you know, and the little straw hat. And, I mean, they set him up with that. And just as soon as he gets out of sight, hat gone, number badge thrown off. So there is that kind of moment where he makes the costume his own as much as he can. He's given a part to play, and even then he has to customize it. Even if it's not by accessorizing it with celery, it's by de-accessorizing it.
So it is an identity, whether it's his identity or the identity they put on him. There is this kind of need to adopt a
societal norm.
Very visible and fixed identity, yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me and talking about this one. We'll be looking at more episodes of The Prisoner as we go along here.
And excellent. It sure as hell beats UFO.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I won't deny that. I am firmly of the category that The Prisoner is undeniably a classic of television. It's a show that makes you think, or it can make you think. As a kid, I don't think it did when I watched it. I thought it was just kind of a straight, kind of cool, weirdy adventure story. But as you get older, you can grow into this one and see the layers. As you say, as an onion, the layers start to get peeled away. And you realize there's another story going on here. And it's a very relevant story to nowadays. Now I'm moving on and I say, well, you know, that was more prescient than I thought it was at the time. You know, but perhaps it's just McGoohan was just a remarkably clear understanding of where we were going to go with computers and privacy and information. Because that's really what this is about. It's about information. It's about having absolute, total information about a person. And we can call that privacy, or we can just call that having you stamped, filed, indexed, briefed, and debriefed, but that's what it comes down to. So, until the next dystopian adventure in The Prisoner, or whatever show we have on next week, thank you again for being here.
A pleasure, as always.
And I hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.